invalidly adopted a standard? And the answer was yes, because you could not determine at the time of the litigation. And I think you ought to just do away with whether federal or state preempts. You look at the language in Section 6, and it's very clear. It says, adopted or approved by a federal or state statute, or means if it's either adopted by one or the other. It does not refer to whether or not there's a conflict, nor whether or not one, the supremacy of the federal government would overtake the state. This is purely a standard for a defense civil claim, and I would think that would be within the state regulatory power no matter what. So you could take the lowest standard and have a good defense.
Representative Baumann.
My question, sort of closely on the heels of Representative Ann Lundson, really is, what recourse is there if the standard is inadequate? I think that answers possibly Representative Burton's question from before. This is looking to a situation where the standard's been set and the standard's been complied with, but there's information, there may be common knowledge among the people who work most closely with the product that the standard is not adequate, and yet there's no incentive for them to increase the quality of the product if the standard is inadequate, and they're the ones who have the best knowledge of the product because they're working with it all the time. I would hate to have an Oregonian be foreclosed from that kind of situation because of what we're doing here today.
I think we tend to forget the underlying issue here. We have a business or an individual who is producing a product, and a governmental body has said you can produce this product as long as you incorporate these safety factors, these precautions, these things that are needed. And under current law, we're saying, but by the way, we're not going to guarantee you that if you do what we told you to do, you'll be protected. All in the world this bill does is says if you meet the rules of the game that the governmental body set up for you, then you can use that as a defense to say, I did what the government told me I was supposed to do when I produced this product, and I don't want you to come in after the game's over and tell me there's a whole new standard. And that's the defense we're building into the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Further discussion?
Just a comment.
Representative Baumann.
I just think the working of this committee shows precisely why there may be more adequate standards than what the government can set, and we should not foreclose people from applying those standards in court.
Okay, if there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll on Representative Dick's motion on the adoption of the Dash 65 amendments.
Baumann?
Aye.
Melanie?
No.
Bunn?
No.
Burton?
No.
Dix?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Phillips?
No.
Springer?
Votes aye. Motion fails. Anything else on Dash 6?
Sure.
Section 6.
Yeah.
Representative Burton?
The reason I voted against it is because it was replacing the chapter. I don't know if this is going to, does product include definition, which I didn't get a chance to ask, include drugs?
Excuse me?
I was in Dave's there.
That's all right. What's addressed by the Dash 65 amendments does not seem in addition to being covered. It should be in addition to Section 6 rather than replacing Section 6.
Well, it's already included in Section 6.
Well, I don't. I must have a different Dash 65 amendment. I don't see where it's included.
Representative Phillips.
Thank you. But it's, I guess we implied it would be included, and if you wanted to specifically enumerate it, you could add it too and set a separate standard for drug. And your
pre-market. Okay.
Okay. Representative Phillips, the next section.
Thank you. The next section is titled Housekeeping. I think that's an appropriate title. We asked counsel, Dix and I, to draft this bill so we could place it into 323 and take out the appropriate sections, and that's what's dealt with there. If you'll turn to page 6 on all of these, you'll see joint and several liability. The threshold standard that was arrived at in this draft, or at least in our draft, Representative Dix and myself, that is, was 15%. You'll see the bill, as approved by the Senate, had a 10% threshold. There was a minority report that offered 20%. See that reflected in -119. The issues in our committee, or in subcommittee rather, Representative Hannah will undoubtedly recall that he asked me to check on line 16, a clarification of the words on the end of that line saying "and shall not be joint." I did that and was informed that that language could indeed stay in the bill. It was also suggested that section 15 of the original 323C be adopted into the bill. And if you have the original 323C in front of you, which now that I've moved all of my papers, I'm not sure I still do. Yeah, I do, in fact. And I was informed that indeed that section was appropriate to be placed back into the bill. So,
which section, Paul?
The section you brought up was section 15 of the original 323C. And I can read that to you if you don't. Oh, you got your bill. Okay. So, as far as the motion, we've already adopted the language with joint and several with the 15% threshold. We have not adopted because of the housekeeping, I'm assuming we've excluded that amendment. But just to make sure that we have not excluded it, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we include section 15 back in the bill as council has advised. And I want you to know that I'm honestly not sure that we took it out, but it's not reflected in this material, so I want to formalize.
Can you say section 15?
Section 15 of the original 323C was not supposed to come out. Representative Hanlon raised that issue. I went back and checked, and he indeed was correct. So I wanted to make sure that we know that it was not supposed to come out.
Okay, Representative Phillips has moved that section 15 of the C engrossed printed bill 323 be specifically retained and made a part of the language that relates to joint and several liability and other appropriate circumstances. Is there further discussion on that amendment? That motion, Representative Hanlon?
I wasn't the one that raised it.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hanlon. I have it noted as your notes. But it was raised. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, further discussion? Any objection?
Yeah.
Representative Hanlon objects. Any further objection? If not, motion's adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bellamy?
I would move to change, to amend this section of joint several to go to 20% instead of 15%. And I believe that's reflected in two places in the amendments, if I read the amendments correctly.
Okay.
I think it's reflected on lines 18 and 21. I don't see it any other place.
So in section or subsection 3 of section 7, where, or in that section relating to joint and several liability, where the percentage is 15%, you would like that to read 20%, is that correct, Representative Bellamy?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Bellamy so moves.
And then it would be the same in sub 4.
Also in sub 4.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Bellamy has so moved, changing 15 to 20 in subsections 3 and subsection 4. Is there further discussion?
Sure.
Representative Burton, then Representative Hamlin.
Could I ask what the magic is on these numbers, and why they're picked at 15 or 20%, and what the discussion was in the subcommittee on making a decision on that percentage?
You don't want to ask, if, you don't want to ask me on the subcommittee?
Well, I guess I'd like to ask you why you want to raise it.
Oh.
Sure.
I think that it has a direct bearing on how I'm going to vote on the cap.
Okay, well, I might just say, Mr. Chairman, it also has a bearing on how I might vote. Therefore, I'm going to oppose the motion until we have some ability to see the rest of the, material in front of us.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamlin, and then Representative Bellamy.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested, since there's a, the 0 to 20% went up, whether or not Representative Bellamy would be interested within our existing law. Let me just give you a background. Our existing law, it used to be that a plaintiff couldn't recover if they were 1% negligent. Called contributory negligence theory. That was changed, Representative Bellamy, so that the person could recover if their negligence was not greater than the combined fault of the people they were making the claim against. Since we're going 20% the other way on the joint and several under the same theory, would you be interested then in allowing a plaintiff to recover rather than at the 50% level, the 70% level?
Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
The answer to that is no, and I will withdraw my motion, because obviously this is tied to caps, and I'll wait to propose this section until, the percentage, until we get to the cap section.
I'll hold mine till then also.
Okay, Representative Bellamy.
Don't, Tom, don't overlook the fact that I did start out with no.
Representative Bellamy asked to withdraw his motion. Is there any objection to that?
Withdrawn.
Anything to the joint and several liability at this time?
Well, again, I don't want to speak for section 11, or the amendment 119, but...
Peg, the...
Representative Dix.
In section 4, where the liability of a defendant who is found to be at least 15% at fault for the economic damages awarded to the plaintiff shall be joint and several. The following three sentences, can you explain to me, or someone explain to me, how a judge is going to instruct a jury? And if we struck those three sentences, would it have a dramatic effect on the section? I mean, I'd like to hear, perhaps maybe the chair or someone else on the committee, if they could tell me how you would instruct the jury with regard to those three sentences.
Representative Bellamy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first, we had a question at one point, why we even needed that language. It isn't a question of an instruction of the jury. You just have, as a matter of law, a situation that if you're below the 15%, you know, you're not jointly liable. So that isn't a jury issue at all, that's just an issue of how the liability is allocated.
So are you saying that it should be struck?
Well, I don't know. Could I ask Mr. Lombard, who's worked with that area, to explain it, Mr. Chairman?
Well, if we're going to ask Mr. Lombard, then I'm going to want to ask some people too.
I don't need to ask anybody, I just don't want to throw it out or make any change until we know what effect changing it has. It certainly doesn't hurt anything, if I might, Mr. Chairman, to say...
Representative Bellamy.
Above 15%, it's joint, and below 15%, it's several, and that's what this says.
Except...
That doesn't even go to the jury.
Okay. I guess my question is, and I'm sorry, Representative Brennan, but if we call, if I, you call, okay, I didn't mean to be harsh in my reply, my apologies. Do we need those three sentences, or don't we?
Well, I have to say that I don't honestly know, but what I do know is that having them in appears to create no harm from my standpoint, because that doesn't go to the jury. But all that's saying is that if you're above the 15%, you're jointly liable. Now, I guess if you didn't have the below your only severally liable, the question might be, what are you? And this makes it absolutely clear as to what your status is when you're below the 15%.
Okay, Representative Baumann.
What evidence was there in testimony in front of the subcommittee of the impact that enacting this provision will have on insurance rates or the availability of insurance?
Well, whoever wants to take a stab at that is free to do so. I guess it will depend on whose recollection you want to rely.
How many of us were there on the subcommittee?
Representative Hamlin.
I'll answer.
And then Representative Bond.
None.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, that's one opinion. Representative Bond?
Mr. Chairman, the testimony that we had both before the interim committee and the subcommittee was that joint and several liability was probably one of the most significant portions of tort reform, and that to the degree you removed third parties from liability for the other party, it created predictability in a greater degree for insurance companies. It's my belief that predictability leads to more availability of insurance, but there's no question that there was substantial testimony that joint several liability was a very central part of the tort reform issue.
Representative Hamlin.
Chair, I'd move deletion on line 22 from the word accept down to the end of line 25.
Representative Hamlin moves in subsection 4 of section 7 -116 amendments that on line 22, at the end of several, delete the comma inserted period, delete the rest of line 22, and delete lines 23, 24, and 25. Is that your motion, Representative Hamlin?
Yes.
Representative Hamlin is so moved. Representative Bunn?
Mr. Chairman, if I might ask the purpose for which Hamlin is making the motion.
To decide the issue so we can get on with the next one.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Since Representative Dix has asked a question concerning it, that there is no reason why it should be in there according to what I heard from you, and I'd like to get it out and get on with it.
Representative,
if Representative Hamlin heard me to say there was no reason for it, I'd like to then restate for his benefit that the language makes it clear that below 15% there is several liability only.
Which lines, again, were you moving to amend?
It's a deletion, line 22 through 25, language after several.
I didn't understand that to be the language Dave was talking about.
Yeah.
It
should read, after you delete the liability, the defendant who is found to be at least 15% at fault for the economic damages awarded, the plaintiff shall be joint and several.
Could I make a comment?
Representative Phillips.
I sought some clarification from a member of the audience to find out exactly what's going on. It's my understanding that that is current Oregon law. It's used as clarification, and I don't see any purpose in taking it out. I go into great detail on it, but for what it's worth.
Okay, if there's no further discussion, clerk will call the roll on Representative Hamlin's motion.
Baumann?
Aye.
Bellamy?
No.
Bunn?
No.
Burton?
Aye.
Excuse me?
Dix?
Aye.
Hamlin?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
No?
Yes. Motion's adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bunn.
I'd just like to say for the record at this time, in terms of establishing legislative intent, that the removal of that language in no way diminishes the several liability at below 15%.
Okay. Contingent fees.
Well, is there any other issues that people want to bring up other than that, the percentage, which is going to be reflected later with the caps? Okay. Contingent fees start on page 6 of all three drafts. The language that was actually adopted in subcommittee at the request of, I believe, Representative Hammond, feel free to correct me if I'm incorrect, on page 7, line 20, would be the insertion of the word written right in front of contingent, or excuse me, don't see. On line 21, the word written in front of settlement, so you have written settlement. And on line 22, you have the word written settlement. That would...
What about line 19 also?
I'm sorry. No.
Okay.
Those were actually adopted in subcommittee by vote, so they should be in the bill. Now, let's go back and go over this. In the main bill as passed dealing with contingent fees, they dealt with the model or the plain language issue. That's in there, which means the attorney shall explain the conditions and agreement, model explanation. It shall be written in plain, simple language. We put in language saying that the state bar should provide a reasonable explanation in the process form, again in plain language. And we also provided that if you went to an attorney, signed a contingent fee agreement, that you would be allowed a 24-hour backout provision. And as you're probably well aware, it's usually 72 hours in contractual backout. But at any rate, and then the major issue, I believe, if there was an issue in this section, was on line 19, page 7, beginning on under 3, it says that the fees that an attorney may charge where a settlement offer is made prior to entering into the contingent fee agreement shall apply only to the increase in the settlement or a greater amount in which the written settlement offer. Let me go through and tell you what that means, because I didn't even read it correctly. What we tried to get at was the issue, if you're injured, you're offered $30,000, you go to an attorney, the attorney was able to raise the ante by another $5,000, let's say now to $35,000, that fee agreement would apply to only the $5,000 versus the $35,000. And I believe when I read that back over that I gave you the wrong location for the adopted language in committee, because what I've gotten down, the settlement offer was contingent that it be a written settlement offer. So they couldn't come back later and say, well, you phoned me up and we offered you $30,000, and then that would get litigated as to whether they really got an offer or not. So the offer would actually have to be in writing.
Mr. Chair, I would suggest that it appears to me in the 119 agreements it says it better.
Yeah.
Representative Bunn.
I would move substitution for the original Senate Bill 323C language in place of the Phillips-Dix language.
And we're still working on this stuff?
There you go.
Do you know what section it is?
I would concur that that is clearer than the, in fact, it's even clearer than the explanations that I just gave.
Okay, Representative Bunn moves adoption of the subsection 3 of dash 8 in the 119 amendments be substituted for the same parallel section in 116.
Questions, Chair?
excuse me, did I misstate the motion that says?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to have Representative Phillips use the language that I drafted there, but that's not what my amendment is. I basically want to go back to the language that requires the contingency fee agreement to be in writing, and eliminates the 24-hour backout clause and all of the other written provisions, and at the appropriate time, I'd like to speak to that motion. So, Mr. Chairman, I would be going back to Section 12 of 323C engrossed.
Okay, so now we're not working off of your 119 amendments.
No, I apologize for the confusion.
That's the same as Phillips in there. But you did some additional language.
Mr. Chairman, if I might try to clarify, there was a discussion that we needed to make it clear on the Phillips amendments that they should be written. So I just tried to clean that language up as not realizing staff was going to do that. Setting that aside, and if my current motion fails, then Representative Phillips is welcome to use that language. But my current motion is to gut his proposal and go back to the original language of the bill, which says the contingency fee has got to be in writing, but it doesn't require the client to be able to back out within 24 hours, doesn't require all of the other conditions and provisions.
Okay. I got it. Thank you. Representative Bunn moves that Section 12 of the printed bill be substituted for Section 8 of the 116 amendments. Is that correctly stated?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Bunn.
Might speak on that. It's very popular in our current situation to do things against attorneys because they're very unpopular in our society. But the testimony that we had before this committee was without exception to the fact that every one of the clients that appeared before this committee appreciated the work that their attorneys had done, had not found problems with the relationship with the attorney or the current standards in the agreements. And I think this sets up onerous, unneeded conditions. To give you another problem, I think good plaintiff's attorneys, when they start a personal injury case, for example, may want to jump on that situation within the first 24 hours and move swiftly to get information at an accident scene or any similar condition. And I think unless there's evidence of the need for this provision, that we ought not to go further than the original bill did.
Okay, thank you. Representative Burton.
Chair, let me see if I understand. Representative Bunn, you're saying that if by restoring the language that on your motion that a written contingency fee would not be required.
No. Under the motion I have, a written contingency fee agreement in simple language would be required, but the additional conditions placed by the Phillips-Dix proposal would not be required under my proposal.
And those additional conditions
Those additional conditions are the ability to have a 24-hour backout by the client, restrictions on what portion of the recovery can have the fee assessed against it. Those are the provisions.
And the bar explanation.
I'm wondering.
And the excuse me.
Oregon State bar explanation of the process for the people.
Representative Burton?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if Representative Bunn, if in dealing with clients of yours, you would recommend that they go into a business deal with someone else without asking for some kind of a ability to have a buyer's remorse clause, which you do when you make any other kind of business deal with anyone else, or without specifying more specifically what kind of arrangement you're making. And essentially, I understand. I don't think that society necessarily thinks of lawyers. Maybe I thought lawyers only thought of as bad folks inside the legislature, but I disagree that there is anything more than a business arrangement being made here.
Well,
and why not allow a person to make a legitimate business? I know that lawyers don't like themselves as business people, but they do pay taxes, business taxes.
Representative Bunn.
Question was asked, shouldn't we let people remove themselves from this agreement just as they do in any other business transaction? I would suggest that in the vast majority of business transactions, we don't allow a person to remove themselves. It's only in those that legislative bodies have clearly identified as having problems that we allow the removal, and this is not one of those that we've identified as having problems. And I have a problem in the relationship of private contract in saying that we'll regulate that private contract in this way without a public policy need. And to me, an obvious extension is that we should begin regulating the contingent arrangements in financial planning, in a whole series of private industry that this doesn't even touch. And I think the only reason, frankly, that attorneys have been touched is because of the particular perception of attorneys in our society. So I again say that there's no evidence that there's the need for a backup, a backout clause. There's no testimony that there are abuses. And I think we simply need to make policy based on the real need.
Okay, is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll on Representative Bunn's motion to substitute the language from 323 section 12 for section 8 of the -116 amendments relating to attorneys' fees and agreements.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanlon.
Question of Representative Phillips.